Look at all those smiling faces.
They're so excited to be here.
You must be on a different Zoom than I am, then.
I'm perpetually smiling. See that?
Yeah, it doesn't count.
It works, though.
Yeah, it's very pleasant. Thank you for doing that.
Just in case you forget who I am.
Yeah. A lot of people use those backgrounds, and I'm not even sure how to do that, but it might be good. Who knows?
And okay. So how many of you have got the automatic feature that makes you look better? You seen that? That's a little
tell us more, Jim. I'm interested in that one.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. I've seen that. And so you can hit a little button there, and it makes you look better.
Make you look younger.
Or younger, yeah. Yeah.
I'm actually using mine right now.
Okay, let's come to order. This is the virtual meeting of the Collin County PUD District 1 Board of Commissioners for May the 10th, 2021. We're still doing it virtually, so here we go. Our first order of business is approval of the consent agenda. There's quite a few items on there. If there's any comments or questions, we can move into those.
Move that we accept the consent agenda.
I had a question first.
Okay, Jim, go ahead.
Probably for Sean. I was noticing on the delinquent payments write-ups, you had three of them there, a commercial and two residential customers. And I noticed a really five-month period, October through January, February, before we actually cut off power. I assume we had a lot of communications going back and forth, because that seems like a long time to string them, to let them, you know, go that long without paying their bills.
Yeah, because of the governor's moratorium, Jim, they just recently opened it up to where we could disconnect commercial accounts. And so we've been doing our best to work with those customers, get on payment plans. And then when they get on a payment plan, we give them more than one opportunity if they break it. But, yeah, after the 5 months on that particular customer, we decided to terminate services for non-payment. Normally, under normal circumstances, it's not that long.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, that answers the question. I guess an observation, then, it's not too bad, then. We really only had one business customer over the last 5 months to get in that situation where we eventually had to cut their power off.
No, we've had more than that. We're doing our best to work with all customers, though, on payment plans. And but we've turned off more than just that one. But this is the only one for that month that actually went through the entire process and is being forwarded to collections.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
I guess I have a question as well for Lori. I hope she's on. On the vouchers, some of the vouchers were annotated as being edited and others were unedited, and there was a difference in some of the annotations. Haven't seen that before. I just wondered what's the definition of being edited.
Do you have an example of one, Will? Is there one where I might have...
No, it's the whole sheet. It's just at the top. It says edited, and there'll be one follow-up that says it's unedited.
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I guess I'd have to find it, but I can get back with you.
Yeah,
okay.
This is T. I know what Will is referring to. It's one of the two reports for the... removal of delinquent accounts, Lori. So that's really Karen's report. Okay. And she provides two reports that look almost alike. And I think Commissioner Waddell had said in the past that it looked like we had duplicate reports in the board packet, but they're really not duplicate reports. He's referring to the two reports that Karen always provides at the beginning of the month for the removal of delinquent accounts, and one of those reports has edits in it, and one is original. So I guess that's just there's a few little differences on one report, and just to let people know that they are not duplicates, I wrote unedited and edited on each of the reports, so that you could. So that's where that comes from.
I need to double check this, but Will, to answer your question, I believe the edited one includes payments that the collection agency received. I will have to double check that. I'm almost positive that's what it is, though.
Okay. Well, it makes sense. Okay, we've got a motion to approve. Do we have a second?
Yeah, I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for May 10th, 2021. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, agenda revisions. Doug, do we have anything?
Oh, nothing today. Well,
we had a nice long agenda, so that's a good answer. Anything from the board?
Nope.
Nope.
Okay. Okay, our next item is comments from the public. Sean, you can handle this. Do we have any comments?
Nothing in chat, but if anybody would like to make a comment, go ahead and let me know at this time, and I can put you on a list.
I guess
hearing none, Will.
Guess not. Yeah. All right, moving on to business items. Our first business item is Reliable Public Power Provider, RP3 presentation. We're going to talk about reliability and system improvement, safety, workplace development, and financial health. The different presenters, I guess the first one is Doug and Nicole.
Yeah, let me start this off if I can, Will. With a little introduction, RP3 stands for Reliable Public Power Provider. As you know, our utility is one of the county's greatest assets, and this RP3 recognition helps us show it to the public. I know how hard our employees work to serve our customers. This designation helps to answer, do we do an outstanding job to keep the lights on? And are employees committed to customer service and safety? So up front, I just want to emphasize the significance of this recognition. And actually, after this one, there's the SEP, which is a smart energy provider program, which Matthias will be working on. But right now, I'll concentrate more on RP3. We also want to show that we don't rest on our success, because we've applied and recognized three times for this RP3 designation. And we continue to strive to, with our best practices, and maintain our competencies, because our customers count on us. We take our vision statement, which is being the best utility for our customers, very seriously. So the RP3 is a regular operational checkup of our utility in the four categories which you mentioned: reliability, safety, workforce development, and system improvement. Participating in this effort helps improve our utility. We've improved it with each submittal. So every time we submit, we actually have improvements. They do have different requirements each time too, which helps us even more so with new technology that's coming out. Like, you know, in the last one, cyber security was an important part of it, and that was one of the sections. We are one of the very few to receive such recognition in the United States. All of our departments contribute, and we now have a team that works together and supports each other, and we kind of make that part of our strategic plan. So this recognition means that we're one of the best. We practice best practices based on industry standards. And with that kind of introduction, I'll turn it over to Nicole, which will kind of lead the next step.
I would like to point out that, of course, this comes from the American Public Power Association. Like you said, it is a national recognition, and it, I guess the APPA has over 2,000 members, so this is pretty significant.
Okay, I'm going to see if I can share my screen here. There we go. No, that is not it. Should be screen two.
I have seen it and it disappeared, Nicole.
Did you see the RP3 thing or just the blank screen?
No, we see the RP3.
Great, perfect. Okay, so let me get my mouse over here. So as Doug and Will were saying, APPA is the American Public Power Association. RP3 stands for Reliable Public Power Provider. Gives you a little bit of information on what the American Public Power Association is. It's been administered by them now. They've been offering the designation for 15 years. This is, again, I want to reiterate that this is for public power utilities. Their review panel has 18 members to try to cover the four disciplines that the designation covers. The other 12 panel members are nominated by the chair of APPA's board. One of those panel seats represents either a joint action agency or state association. Six of the panel seats are for two representatives each from small, medium, and large public power utilities. And the other five panel seats are for representatives of reliability, safety, system improvement, and human resources. Why we apply? As Doug was saying, it is a sign of us having an efficient, safe, and reliable distribution system. This award does pertain to the electric side of a utility. It demonstrates to stakeholders in the utility that, you know, community leaders, board members, suppliers, vendors, bonding agencies, especially customers, our commitment to this. It's also an opportunity for us at the PUD to kind of perform a self-assessment against an established standard, and we can incorporate feedback into both our strategic plan and planning for future application periods. Utilities also can have some side benefits from this, improved bond ratings, potentially savings on workers' comp and insurance, increased economic development opportunities, as other entities that may be wanting to come to the area learn about the designation here. This and then the smart energy provider designation that you'll hear about later are both highlighted in the annual report that Lori's currently working on right now. So the designation lasts for 3 years, recognizing specifically public power utilities in four key disciplines of reliability, safety, workforce development, and system improvement. Now, following PUD, we first applied in 2013, receiving the award in 2014, and at that time we were a platinum designation. You can see the levels in the chart there. This was always announced at the Engineering and Operations Conference. We reapplied for the second time in 2016 and received the designation in 2017, this time with 97.5 total points, and we were still at platinum at that point, just under. Then when we reapplied in 2019 and received the designation last year, we knew we were close, but we got a perfect 100 points. So now we've been working on tracking our progress and getting prepared for the next application period for us, which will be in 2022. The reapplication process, it helps us ensure that we're not getting complacent. We're consistently striving to maintain and improve the quality of the system. So there are over 2,000 public power utilities in the United States, and they just had their engineering and operations conferences and awarded the new designees. So as of 2021, 269 utilities out of that 2,000 hold the RP3 designation. and 127 of that are at diamond level. And there are five utilities holding the RP3 designation in Washington State. They are all at the diamond level. There were seven, so a couple of them dropped off. So now we're down to five in Washington State. Just to give you an idea of the undertaking, this one took seven of us. Usually it's been about the same seven here over the three applications that we've put forth. We allow ourselves 4 months to kind of work on collating the information, getting everything together. The first time we had to do it, we had to submit a physical binder, and the thing must have been 5 inches thick. It was a pretty big undertaking. Now they've streamlined it in a digital application format, so you can upload your documents that way. But our goal actually has been to submit at least a month prior to the deadline. So they give you about 5 months. We like to get it in about 30 days early, just in case, because if the review panel has any questions at all, you get one shot where they'll issue a request for information for any clarification that they need, and you have a very limited time to respond. We ended up in that 4 months, they had 38 questions in the application, and we had 131 attachments to the application that we had to upload. And the criteria is posed as questions within each of those four disciplines based on leading business practices intended to represent a utility-wide commitment to safe and reliable delivery of electricity. So I'm going to quickly touch on the four, and then we'll turn it over to the different team members. The first one is reliability, and this one had sections that John Purvis, Steve Schopfer, and Larry Morris all needed to address, and you can see the subsections that covers under reliability. And it includes collecting and analyzing reliability data, having a mutual aid agreement, devising and using system-wide disaster management or an emergency response plan, and implementing cyber and physical security. Next is safety. Utilities must create a culture of safety with a commitment from top management, and all aspects of operations from power generation to line work have safety protocols. And so the delivery of safe and reliable electricity demands benchmarking safety metrics, focusing on frontline workers and implementing safety training. And so in the application, we must indicate that we have an accepted safety manual that's being used, work practices, benchmarking and tracking, and ours extends even to clerical staff, frontline workers, CSRs. We have safety training that goes across the entire utility. Workforce development, that is all Jamie's, covers a variety of subsections. This describes how you train your staff through webinars, workshops, conferences, college courses, or in-house, how we provide opportunities for staff to network with public power colleagues across the nation, how do we encourage employees to expand their perspective through memberships in state, regional, and national committees and programs. Let's see, and how we prepare for succession planning, employee enrichment. And then lastly, system improvements. This one's research and development, system maintenance and betterment, and then the financial health of the utility. And John Purvis and Sean Worthington both worked on this section. This demonstrates stewardship of utility assets to maintain system integrity, initiating programs to promote long-term planning through system improvement and future-proofing. And we need to show how our participation in research and development programs creates procedures to maintain the distribution system and financial health. So once the application is sent in and they send back any requests for information and we fulfill that before the final cutoff, when we finally get our application approved, they come back with recommendations if they have any feedback. And so you can see in 2013, the recommendations in 2013 and 2016, we did end up fulfilling all of those recommendations. When we submitted in 2013, at the time, we just had a table of contents and kind of a framework for our disaster plan. And so we had received partial credit at that time. So we completed that. The R&D program, providing more data in the financial system improvement section, the benchmarking survey, cybersecurity assessments. Then in 2019, they didn't have any additional feedback, but we can't just sit back and expect that that's going to carry forth. And part of the reapplication process is every application period, there's a little variation in the questioning as the review panel wants to maybe dial something in, maybe there's a new technology that's come up or a new benchmarking, something they want to track. There's variations in them, and so just because there's no additional recommendations doesn't mean that we stop pursuing continuous performance improvement, and that enters into one of our strategic plan objectives. So it's definitely a continuing performance improvement in looking at what the next application period is going to do. They'll probably open it up, I want to say it's usually around May, April or May of each year, so we won't know until next spring what the new application is going to look like. They do help you with some webinars about the four sections to give you kind of an idea, but it's after that that we really take off running. So now I'd like to turn it over to the first section and team responsible for that area, but does anybody have any questions at the high level about the program itself?
So this is really a very broad benchmarking exercise, am I right?
Yeah, I think you're going to see in the different four sections, though, that it does get into some pretty good weeds. It's a real comprehensive application, and that's what makes it so great for us when we're looking at different projects or maybe we're looking at something we want to implement. We can really see and tie it in with not only what we're going to be applying for the application and documenting as we move forward, but we can also tie it into our goals and projects for the strategic plan when we're closing those gaps. So we turn it into a whole wraparound process for the utility.
Nicole, do you know who the other four recipients in Washington State were?
Oh, yeah, let's see.
Yeah, I've got them here, Nicole. There's.
I guess this is the updated list because a couple of them dropped off. There's four, Benton, Clark, Cowlitz, and Mason, and then Seattle City Light. I don't remember who dropped off.
You might notice that Seattle City Light and Clark PUD and Cowlitz, pretty large utilities. Of the 30-plus public utilities in Washington State, we're one of the five here.
And we qualify as a large utility for our size, but we're at the definite small end of that large utility category.
So Snohomish didn't make that list?
They are not on the list.
When you get down to the SEP, the Smart Energy Provider, Snohomish is one of them on the list, but not for this one, no.
Okay, so we are moving into reliability, so I'll turn that over to John.
Okay, I hope everybody is seeing my screen.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. Let me get some things configured here. All right. I'm going to apologize. We are going to go a little bit into the weeds. That's probably the only way for us to effectively convey the scope of the APPA evaluation. And Nicole mentioned there was 131 attachments, and that is literally thousands of pages. One attachment could be as much as 200 to 300 pages, as much as 400 pages. So there's quite a few megabytes or even gigabytes involved as far as the submissions. I'm going to cover five aspects that Nicole mentioned on the reliability section, including indices collection, how we use indices, mutual aid, disaster plan, and physical security. Okay, for the first question, does your utility monitor and track reliability data? And if yes, what methods does your utility use to monitor and track reliability data? We substantiated our submission with a comprehensive OMS history, an illustration of outage causes, outage reports, many outage reports, as well as outage tracking data sheet, which is made up of an export of OMS that then goes into a long-running spreadsheet that goes back even before 2009. And this is the type of information we occasionally share with the board and try to do it quarterly or annually to give you an overview of how our system's performing. Okay, question two, use the table below to indicate each reliability statistic tracked by your utility and provide the most recent year's calculations. And there's a lot of acronyms, SAIDI, CAIDI, AC, MAFI, SAIFI, and I'm not going to go into any great detail on what those means, but for example, the SAIDI is the System Average Interruption Duration Index, and it measures the average frequency duration or hours that our customers are out per year. We also give a quick example of outage indices reporting, and you see this every now and again as commissioners, and we track this information by quarterly and year. SAIDI, CAIDI, SAIFI, ASI, which is another form of SAIDI, actually. And then SAIDI with and without major events. We do it both ways and have all that information readily available and submitted to that group. We also have our reports to governance and our strategic reporting. We make that information available to APPA, and we incorporate reliability objectives into our district planning study. And for this question, we got 4 out of 4 full credit. Okay, our next question is, does your utility use service reliability indices to maintain and improve utility operations? If yes, how is your utility using service reliability indices to improve the system? Now, you may notice we don't check everything. In some ways, this question is somewhat legacy. We have far stronger tools than reliability indices to meet these objectives, and in many ways, indices are a secondary method of reaching these objectives. We didn't include installed covered wire. We don't use tree wire in our system. For a variety of reasons, we try to maintain our vegetation management program where we keep trees well away from lines. In some urban areas with tree-lined boulevards, they actually allow the trees to grow around the wire, and we just simply do not do that here due to reasons I will not go into. Also, for thermographic and transformer load management, we perform these as preventative maintenance as opposed to outage-related maintenance. But we do enough to get full credit on this question, and we use indices for cable fault tracking. We have strategic objectives and initiatives. Outage caused by feeders due to trees. We just give certain examples. And we give an example of how we use our system to even mitigate wildlife contacts. And this is a short document giving an overview. Yes, we have a overhead transformer outage due to wildlife. That is how it looks in our OMS system with all the characteristics, including geolocation, structure number, GPS. It has all that information immediately recallable. And when we have Eagle fatality, we do further documentation of what we did to mitigate it. Here we have triangles installed on the cross arms to discourage purchasing by avian birds. And where appropriate, we fill out fish and wildlife reports on any bird fatality that we're aware of, and especially for eagles and the like. So we show them what we do, and they evaluate us on that. On this, we got 4 out of 4 for the full credit. Question 1B2 is, do you participate in a distribution system reliability survey? And we do participate in the APPA. Unfortunately, we missed this in a prior year, and we did not get diamond level for that very reason. So we're very diligent and making sure we do participate in the survey, and we have one coming up this summer. We want to make sure we accomplish full credit, two out of two for that. Question 1C1, does your utility participate in a mutual aid program? If yes, identify the programs, types your utility participates in, and attach documentation. We actually are part of three mutual aid agreements, APPA, Washington PUD Mutual Aid Plan, and the Bonneville Power Administrative Mutual Aid Agreement. To get full credit, you have to be a member of a national organization, and that is one of the reasons in 2013 we joined the APPA Mutual Aid Agreement, although it is very rare that we'd actually use APPA. Our first go-to list is the Washington PUD Mutual Aid Group. But if we were to have a big earthquake, we probably could not get aid from the other utilities in the state. We would have to rely on the APPA. And for documentation, we'll include the whole plan. And our superintendents typically manage this program in consultation with other superintendents throughout the state, and gives all our rates and everything and all the information you need to rapidly get outside resources. Because we are subject to winds and we either participate in assistance or request assistance periodically, this is a fully developed process for us. We got 3 out of 3 credit on this question. It also has, does your utility have a disaster plan or emergency response plan, or does your city have a disaster plan, which includes electric utility-specific section? And for all the check marks in the application, our plan did cover. And one of the things we did with our plan is we looked at APPA recommendations for a disaster plan. So, of course, we would adopt all those elements that APPA and others look at. We also looked at places like Florida and California who have earthquake or hurricane plans that are well developed. So we took a close look at those when we developed our plan. And for this question, we submitted our ERRP, or disaster plan, and 38 attachments to the ERRP plan. And this plan includes everything from earthquakes, ice storms, windstorms, wildlife, and almost anything else you can imagine. I believe that our plan is probably, my guess is it's probably superior to any plan in the state, maybe even better than your large municipalities. It's very comprehensive. We developed it over more than a 5-year period, and we received a score of 4 out of 4 for the plan. Next question, has your utility addressed its physical security needs? And we checkmarked what we do, and it looks like we covered everything except for detailed background investigation for every employment offer for every employee. But our submission was sufficient to get full credit, 3 out of 3. And we also had an additional submission of sabotage reporting that we developed during our years as a NERC-registered utility. Okay, this section, RP3 reliability, I'm going to turn over to Steve, our expert in cybersecurity. And Steve, do you want me to drive the presentation, or do you want to share your screen here?
Sure, go ahead. You can keep driving. It's all right. So there were 3 questions on the cybersecurity part of the plan. Does your utility have a policy or procedure in place that covers both cyber event prevention and response in the case of an attack? And every one of these bullets was one of the questions that we answered correctly. So we got a score of 1 out of 1 for those. We maintain all of our assets. We monitor on a 24/7 basis all suspicious activity. We have several layers of tool suites, firewalls to, you know, keep bad people out of our system. We have a recovery plan in case there's an incident. And we have clearly assigned people in IT who are responsible for anything that comes up. And we do get incidents. We do get hit. probably a few times a week. But with our 24/7 monitoring, my guys are on top of it. Within a couple of seconds of it happening, they let the person who may or may not have let somebody in know. We block it and take appropriate action. Next slide. Has your utility trained all relevant employees? Yes, we train people all the time. We do, they understand what sensitive information is. About every 2 or 3 months, I will send out a reminder email to employees to be careful about phishing attacks and spam attacks. All employees are trained on who have access to critical assets, people with iPads, iPhones, surfaces out in the field. And again, we have established procedures for incident responses, again, by using different types of applications and procedures that we have in place. Next one. And does your utility conduct periodic cybersecurity assessments? Yes, we do that as well. Again, we monitor 24/7. If something happens in the middle of the night, my guys are on it. They get, you know, notices on their phones. They get up, take care of things. We have multiple layers of antivirus. In fact, we have three layers, just so you know, we have three layers of antivirus and two layers of firewalls that protect us from the outside. And, of course, we do periodic evaluations with other utilities. We've done what are called pen testings, that last bullet, third-party penetration testing and assessments, where we will allow a consultant to come in and try to hack into us, and then based upon what they found, how far they got, then we will go back and tighten up any areas that they may have gotten into, which, by the way, they never have. But you never know. It's a good thing we don't have a pipeline running to the East Coast right now. So, yeah, we're good there, too. So, and we got three out of the three. There was a one for each of the three sections, and we got three out of three for all three sections. So,
yeah, and I'll add, in light of what's going on recently, even going back 2 or 3 years, I fully expect APPA to dig a little bit deeper into cybersecurity this next time around. We may see additional questions or more emphasis on some of the questions.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's going to be more than three areas next time around for next year's.
Yeah, Steve, I had a question. We're not controlling anything. Well, maybe we are. We've got a lot of smart devices in our substations and so on. Is there an air gap there between so people can't get in through the internet?
Yes, there is. The SCADA system is what you're talking about is separate from the business network. It's a separate network running on a separate set of servers, on a separate system, completely different from what's running the business applications here in the admin building and throughout the district. So,
great. That's great.
Hey, and I will also add that we operate our SCADA in remote disabled, which means that you have to be at the location of the equipment to operate the equipment. We cannot actually switch devices in the office because it requires one to throw a switch at the local equipment location. And because we're not 24/7 and we don't maintain 24/7 system operations, we still require an electrical switchman or operator to visit locations to throw even our automated switches because they're disabled from remote operation. We use SCADA primarily for
monitoring
and indications.
So our
SCADA supervisory control and data acquisition is really just data acquisition.
Yeah, there's no control. It's just monitoring.
Right.
We could, but we choose not to. So.
But we do test the system. We go in and we test it out, but when we test it, somebody is physically there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, let me try to stop sharing. I think I'm doing that. Yes.
Who are you turning over to, John?
I believe this is going to Larry for the safety section.
You're muted, Larry.
Good afternoon. I was muted there for a minute. It took a while for me to realize that I'm going to have a little help here with this program, but I'll read from it. My section is safety, and the subsection is safety manual. Manual development and update. The district safety manual, the accident prevention rulebook, which we use, has and was developed in-house through years. And through those years, there's been times that things have changed, and we've had to add or make corrections.
Hey, excuse me, Larry. It doesn't look like you're thumbing through the presentation.
Okay. There we go. It did move.
Okay, you didn't allow me to do it.
You want? How do you do it here? Okay. There it is. Is it, can you see that one? Or I got two pages here.
Well, you need to go to here.
Okay. I did that. I didn't do that. You brought that up. I think that's it from your desk.
Yeah.
I got to go share screen.
Yeah, you got to do share screen from yours. Okay.
Yeah, you're on. Once you delete yours, I can go to share screen. Give us just a second. Hey, T, yours is still up. Give us a second here. Okay, there it is. No, I don't want that. I want this one. There you go. Come on.
Generally.
Can anyone see this screen that I've got up other than my calendar?
Yes.
You can't see the subsection safety manual?
Yes.
Thank you. Then we'll see where we go with this. So I'll start again. The subsection of the subsection of this manual is safety. Is the safety manual. It was developed through years. And it's an in-house publication, and it's been through the years that it's been either updated or corrected. This manual is reviewed and updated every 5 years, and on that case, we got 4 out of 4. Employee review of manual. The accident prevention rulebook is reviewed at employees at least annually and whenever it is updated. The last time the book was updated was 2016. We're in the process right now of reviewing it. What I do is I send all supervisors questioning if they've seen anything they'd like to look at to see if we need to make changes on. To this date, I have not heard anything. I also look to see if we received anything from LNI that would affect our safety manual, and as so far, I have not. That one we got 4 out of 4. On the directive, employees are directed by management via the accident prevention directive to read, use, and understand the accident prevention rulebook. That's something that we do on an annual basis. Okay. Okay, subsection safe work practice. Safety meeting. The district holds safety meetings for operational and field employees. That would be our water department, our lines, crews, substation, anyone out in the field. These meetings take about 1.5 to 2.5 hours in length. The district holds quarterly safety meetings for management and administrative employees. These meetings are normally about 1.5 hours long. Our presentations for the administration were going to be a little different than they are going to be for the field employees. So that's about the only difference that we have, but we try to keep, make sure that they're kept in loop with anything that's going on in safety, violence in the workplace, what to do in certain situations. That's just one of the things. Senior management actively participates in the district safety training initiative for all employees at least once a year. Many times our administration is in on a lot of the safety meetings that we have on a monthly basis as well. The written policy and practice to enforce the safety manuals. The district realizes the Clallam County PUD safety practices and the accident prevention rulebook to facilitate the enforcement of its safety rules. And out of this, we got one out of one. Under subsection safety work practices, job site inspections, the district conducts monthly or more frequently job site inspections and utilizes a standard job site inspection form to do so. I go out once a month or more so from time to time just to check on the crews and document how they're doing. The other thing we do is there is a job briefing for the employees. The district holds job briefings for electric employees prior to start of each job and utilizes the crew job briefing form to do so. In this section, we received 2 out of 2. And continuing with safe work practices. Safety orientations for non-utility employees. The district conducts a safety orientation with all non-utility employees, contractors, mutual aid situations, working on our system to ensure compliance with the district's safety standards. That would be very similar to the information transfers. We have a contractor working for us. We have to make sure that they understand where we're at, what we're doing, and what the hazards are. The district does so utilizing the following contractor safety plan, which we have. And then again, we go back to the 6729-64567 under the host and contractor information transfer. We have to follow these items. We have to give nominal voltages on the line, maximum switching transit voltages, the presentation of hazards induced in voltages, and presence of protective ground and equipment grounding conductors. We also have the locations of the circuits and equipment, including electrical supply lines, communications line, and fire protective signals. The conditions of protective grounds and equipment grounding conductors, and the condition of the poles. Also, the environmental conditions related to these safety. That was right out of the 6-7 section. The contract and mutual aid requirements are covered under 29645. Our primary mutual aid agreements identify the effective safety policies and practices that are in effect, which are governed by state law based on the language of 1926 Section B. And we received a 1 out of 1 on that. Okay, slide 4. Accident investigation actions. The district changes its safety practices, rules, or takes action to promote safety based on findings from accident investigations or near misses reported when appropriate. The district utilizes the accident investigation plan and the near miss sections of the safety meeting to do so. Within our safety meetings, we talk about any accidents or injuries that occurred or any near misses. It's good to talk about the near misses in these safety meetings because it brings to light anything that might jog someone's mind about something that we need to make corrections to that we may not be aware of. The district has automated external defibrillators, AEDs. The district provides automated external defibrillators at all district properties for which personnel are assigned. A sufficient number of AEDs are assigned to district vehicles to ensure that all temporary job sites, including construction sites, I'm covered by AEDs. We do that on, we have 66 at this time. Some of the work practices that we have are required by OSHA, and these are topics, and some are going to be hands-on training or refresher courses that we do on an annual basis. Bucket truck train or rescue is reviewed annually with hands-on. Cranes and derricks are topics that we follow. Confined space rescue and permit required rescue are also a hands-on. We have a spot out at Carlsberg. We do that. Hazardous control, that's a topic that we use. We also talk about hazardous material. We have topics on job briefings. And we also go over what to do in an incident investigation. Every 2 years, we have CPR and AED. On the years that we do not have them, we have a refresher course. So we're continuously looking at our CPR and AEDs. We have ladder safety, lockout, tagout procedures. And then again, we have our pole top rescue, which ties in with our bucket truck rescue on the same day that we have that plan to do. We also have topics on enclosed spaces and working underground, underground electrical transmission distribution work, and hazard recognition in trenching and shoring. On that section, we got 2 out of 2. Okay, continuing on slide 5. ARC hazard assessment. The district performs an ARC hazard assessment for all areas where personnel are exposed to electrical hazards. The district utilizes the Incident Energy Analysis OSHA ARC flash assessment and the Operations FR training presentation to do so. In this section, we scored 2 out of 2. Under disaster drills, district conducts disaster drills that are energy response and emergency plan, electrical utility specific drills, addressing winter storms, winter winds, earthquakes, active shooters, fires, and drills. And also in that section, we got 2 out of 2. In the last section, which is indexing, benchmarking, the district participates in the following safety index benchmarking surveys and services. We benchmark with the Association Safety Awards of Excellence, the APP Safety Award of Excellence, NWPPA Utility Safety Contest, and we provide information for our annual OSHA 300 form, and in that we received a 2 out of 2. I hope I didn't confuse anyone. I may have been talking too fast. My mouth is very dry. Is there any questions? I must have stunned you or I'm on mute.
Good job, Larry. Good job.
Okay, thank you. I'm done.
Okay, who are you turning over to, Larry? I think Jamie, huh?
Yeah, I think it's
Jamie. Yes, it is. My turn, and share a screen here with you guys. Here we go. Share. Good afternoon, everyone. Really hard to follow Larry and beat him. So I'm going to bring to you guys workforce development, and within the workforce development section of the RP3 application, we have 3 subsections, which include succession planning and recruitment, employee development and recognition, as well as education, participation, and service. So the first question that we see under workforce development is, have your utility identified the demographics of its employees to prepare for succession planning? And the answer is yes. When we work on succession planning, we look at 3 different criteria, age, eligibility for retirement, and their position. And when we submitted in 2019 our application, our data
showed us that in the next 5 years, 18% of the district's workforce is eligible to retire, 30% are eligible in the next 10 years, and then over the past several years, we've seen 1 to 2 employees leave the district, not as retirees. So with our data that we collect, we were able to receive a 3 out of 3 on that question. The second question is, has your utility addressed knowledge management, has your utility addressed knowledge management relative to the changing workforce? So over the next 10 years, with the potential of 30% of our employees being eligible for retirement, it has been vital for the success of our workforce and for our operations to run smoothly how important cross-training is. Our customer service department, they are a great example of cross-training. Their customer service reps are trained in the remittance processing desk as well as credit collections, and that provides reliability and business continuity for us. The district has also conducted in-house training over the last several years, hosting NWPPA Leadership Program. This program has helped us create a culture here where managers, supervisors, and foremen have been able to receive consistent training, strengthening and developing our lead employees. And then hiring for critical positions prior to departure, this allows us for smoother transitions and knowledge sharing. With enough notice and identifying positions, we are able to actively recruit, hire, and transition those employees smoothly. One of my favorite bullets here is establishing relationships with universities and trade or technical schools. So Clallam PUD has been a key employer in the community and has been participating in school and community career fairs for well over 10 years. We travel all over from CQNU Bay all the way out to back to SWIM, really networking with our youth here, even Peninsula College, and demonstrating to them just different opportunities that they can have right here in their hometown. The district also has an excellent apprenticeship program approved by our state of Washington. This allows us to develop and train internally positions like our journeyman linemen, journeyman tree trimmers, meter technicians, and our existing journeymen, they just take a lot of pride in this program, I think, because they're being able to develop future employees. It's really exciting when we have people enter our apprenticeship, and then when they top out with their journey level cards, we really take a lot of pride in that program. And then this year, something that we'll be adding to our next RP3 application is we have been working really closely with Energy Northwest. I've got to work hands-on with them in recruiting an engineer intern for us this summer. And so we will be onboarding that intern here in a couple weeks. And they have just developed an amazing program that I know is going to expand, and I'm glad we're one of the first utilities to jump on board with that. That was already highlighted, like Nicole says, you know, we're already looking forward to our next RP3 application, and that will definitely be added to it. And then we're also actively recruiting for an intern in our water department this year as well. So that'll be something that we haven't done for a long time that will, you know, give our employees, I think it's a little bit of fun to bring on a student and get to show them the ways and how utilities work. So for this section, we did receive a 5 out of 5. And then we have, does your utility have practices or procedures in place to address employee recruitment and retention? And the district's a great example for this is our Excellence in Performance Recognition Program. It's a great way for supervisors to recognize employees. Even peer-to-peer recognition can happen through this. There are various levels an employee can be recognized for, depending on, you know, how above and beyond they went on a certain project or helping out. Regarding flexible hours, flex schedules are utilized here at the district for employees to create longer working hours to accommodate travel time when heading out west to a job site. That's just one of the examples. We have a very large service area, so like our right-of-way maintenance operators, when they are spending a time period heading out west or leaving Port Angeles, if we can increase their day and create this flexible working schedule, then they're able to use some of that time for travel, and we're seeing more productive work during the day. The district's comp time policy is a newer policy here at the district, and this allows employees to bank a limited amount of hours to be used in lieu of earning overtime. Employees are really appreciating this. It kind of gives them another bucket to utilize and take time out of without dipping in or exhausting their personal time off banks. And then the wellness program here at the district is a great way to support employees' work-life balances. Employees receive a capped reimbursement for things like gym memberships, workout equipment, sports activity fees. The program is overseen by a wellness committee that is made up of several of our employees here, and they do a great job at supporting the well-being of other employees and their families. And a great example of something they've organized is coming up this weekend is the Olympic Peninsula's Frosty Moss, and this is an 80 and 30-mile relay run across the Olympic Peninsula. And so the wellness committee worked really hard, and they rallied up three teams that will be competing this coming Saturday. So I'm sure you guys will see pictures of that in newsletters, and hopefully everybody's smiling at the finish line. And so for, you know, all of those different items that we do to support employee recruitment and retention, we received a 2 out of 2 on that score. Also under this section, does your utility participate in compensation or salary benchmarking at least once every 3 years? So if you ask HR right now, one of our big seasons is salary survey season, and that is what we are in the middle of right now. So the district actively participates in salary and other informational surveys through APPA, WAPUTA, NWPPA. And then independent to those, we conduct a thorough compensation and benefit survey with Milliman every 3 years for our staff employees. So with those practices that we have, we received a score of 1 out of 1. Then under the new subsection of employee development and recognition, they ask us, at the time of annual review or other time of year, does your utility set personal and or professional goals for every employee? So we have two resources here at the district. Personal and professional goals can be established formally through our fireside chats. These are issued to union employees, and performance appraisals are given to our staff employees. These two forms may include defined development plans for employees, and they offer steps for employees to better themselves as individuals and help with career growth. So we provided, you know, when Nicole and John have talked about all the attachments, they received our fireside chat form as well as our performance appraisal form that was taken into consideration for the evaluation of the score that we received a 3 out of 3. And then subsection education, participation, and service. They asked us, does your utility have a written education policy, procedure, or program for professional development? And we have, yes, we do. We have several different areas. For a number of years, the district has had an active tuition reimbursement policy that employees have utilized to obtain AA degrees, bachelor's degrees, and even their master's degrees to further their careers here. The district has an agreement with Grays Harbor and other utilities for the purchase of a trans banker that is utilized for our line apprentices. And as I mentioned earlier, the intern joining us through Energy Northwest is just another great example that we'll be adding to our future RP3 applications. Other agreements the district has cover online learning and training resources for our employees. We have safety training that is set up online and accessible to all of our employees for them to complete those courses. And then our employees utilize the Learning on Demand program through Northwest Public Power Association. These resources have interactive online courses on electric utility basics, the history of public power in the Northwest, videos on various communication skills, and HR law trainings for managers. LinkedIn Learning is another great online resource offering hundreds of engaging, top quality courses that are taught by recognized industry experts, and that is accessible to all of our employees. And then the district's employees assistant program through Wellspring has various pre-recorded webinars on demand, and as well as, you know, set up on calendar for upcoming webinars on a variety of personal and wellness topics that our employees utilize as well. Another question, kind of sub-question that was set in this, was how does your utility communicate policies, procedures, and programs? So we have various ways to communicate to our employees. We have, you know, traditional email. We have all-employee email. We have an internal newsletter called our web that comes out monthly. Office postings in all the locations, you'll see actually bulletin boards that are dedicated to district-wide communication. We also have virtual bulletin boards. Nicole helps manage those, and she does a great job. Anytime we have a new opportunity, she'll get that posted for us so that we can send that out. As well as our intranet. That's a great internal resource for our employees to have access to policies and procedures and information that might pertain to them in their position. And then how frequently are these policies, procedures, and programs communicated? So upon hire, we have a very thorough onboarding process. We have a new hire starting today, so he'll spend majority of the day in human resources. Prior to COVID, they would actually go around and tour all the other locations so they become familiar with areas that they may not frequent much once they get settled into their position. And they'll go over our policies, our employee handbook, and then other frequencies, you know, monthly, annually, we get out and communicate any changes to our policies, procedures, new opportunities to our employees as well. So we were able to receive a 4 out of 4 on that question. And then question C2 here, does your utility support networking and personal professional development by encouraging attendance across all employee groups at a wide variety of continuing education classes, workshops, local, state, national conferences, and attendance participation in user interest group meetings? The district absolutely supports travel and training for employees to help develop them in their current positions as well as future positions. In this section, we were able to identify representation from both represented and non-represented employees under all of these categories that are listed here. We provided to APPA a detailed list. I believe it was about 3 pages. That we attached to the RP3 application, identifying local, state, and national memberships that our employees represent the district at. And then a little bit further on there, does your utility encourage and support active memberships in professional, community leaderships, and service-based organizations that benefit the utility? So I believe this section is supported by just hiring excellent employees. With a strong and healthy workforce that gives 100% at work, we're naturally going to see that copy over into our community. Our employees are active in many professional organizations representing the district and boards. Within the community, our employees participate, you know, some of the examples would be Chamber of Commerce, Port Angeles Business Association. We see them on Little League boards and active in the United Way. And we were able to score a 3 out of 3 with the information we provided for this request. So that concludes workforce development. Are there any questions?
Yeah, Jamie, I have one. Maybe I missed it somewhere in that long list of stuff that they ask us about. It's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
Did they, what about employee surveys, to see how the employees are doing, that kind of survey, was that, is that part of their assessment?
You know, I don't know that there's a specific section in here about, like, employee feedback. I think that's probably something that we could anticipate as this award grows and they come up with more questions, because the application process is a little different every time. But I cannot identify, I'm just kind of scanning this right here, where employee feedback was a section that they asked for, because I think that would have been a great answer for that. We probably would have referenced the last one we did. I know we do, Nicole, we'll be working on getting one here for probably next year, I think it is. And Nicole, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's right. We're scheduled on our regular cycle, we're scheduled for next year.
Yeah, so we might be able to intertwine that into one of the answers on the next application.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie, I have a question. These internships, are these paid positions? Or?
They are paid positions, yes. So this is kind of exciting. It's been a while since we've had an intern. And Energy Northwest, I'm getting to work over there with one of their employees named Sarah. She is just phenomenal. She's going to have this engineering intern doing monthly coffee chats. They get to network through the industry. It's much bigger than just us hiring an intern right off the street. So it will be really great to be part of this kind of kickoff, and hopefully this program continues to grow. She's been working really hard on it.
Good to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, Jamie, you turn it over to who? John and Sean, I think, right?
Okay, does everyone see the RP3 system improvement screen?
Yeah, we can see it, John.
Okay, let me get things configured real quick. Okay, so basically the last section of the RP3 includes subsections on research and development, system maintenance and betterment, as well as financial health. Okay, and question, the first question in this section is your utility a member of a research and development program? And we have to substantiate what we have done and what we do in this respect. We are currently a member of APPA DEED, which is a research program or subsection of APPA that includes a vast amount of content on current and historical research and development. This goes back many, many years to when utilities were first undergrounding cable. They had a lot of work on how to underground electric systems many, many years ago. More recently, we're getting into content such as voltage optimization, CVR programs, distribution storage, batteries, among others. Vehicle charging, and we're also a consumer of DEED Star, which includes a lot of conservation and energy efficiency programs. And as part of our application for APPA, we substantiated our microgrid project grant application last time around. We were unsuccessful, but it did give us a full credit of 3 out of 3 for research and development. And next application, we plan to use our collaboration with PNNL that the commission authorized recently, and we do appreciate that. So I think we'll have a very robust response to this question again going forward. Question 4B1, does your utility have and maintain records of all plant assets requiring maintenance, including a documented maintenance and inspection schedule? Absolutely, we do. This is a core function of our jobs. The submissions included contract pole test and treat, vegetation management, our district line inspection program and documentation, electric system inspection schedules and documentation, oil testing, infrared testing, and various substation inspections, schedules and documentation, meter testing, distribution transformer testing, as well as protective device testing, primarily relay testing. And here in June, based on Rick's inquiry, we're going to zero in on the vegetation management program, as well as our protective device testing related to what NERC refers to as PRC, and we'll go into a lot more detail. For this application, I'm just going to go into some of the substantiation we do for device protection testing. And for that, we submitted a total of 60-some-odd pages for that. We have CT tests. We have high and low side protection results. And we do this on all our equipment at certain schedules. But it's pretty substantial. And I want to emphasize that it's not just the speakers who contribute to the RP3. I would venture to say that as many as 30 people are involved in the Clallam PUD submission. For the sections I'm involved in, it's probably more than a dozen people and probably closer to 20 people who contribute major sections of this, even down to the linemen and substation technicians who actually day-to-day run our programs. And on this, we did get a final score of 4 out of 4 for this part of our utility programs. Does your utility have any processes or programs in place that addresses overall system losses? Absolutely. Everything that they asked or inquired about, yes, we actually do and do proactively. You know, balancing phases, parallel feeders, volt VAR management, voltage upgrades, conductor upgrades, theft prevention, losses, we do it all. Some of our submissions include our system loss worksheet, various engineering capital improvement plans. Everything that goes before the board for your approval has an underlying capital improvement plan for many years in advance. We also do distribution transformer loss evaluation on procurement. And we also do something called voltage optimization CVR, conservation voltage reduction. And part of our submission gave an example of our Agnew CVR project that talks about our analysis of how much we will save or expect to save for the analysis, the control points where they are in the system, and an overall map explaining how we maintain voltage control to minimize system losses. And this is something utilities have been getting into in recent times, and we're probably more on the lead. This is one area we're more on a leading edge, but we have a very effective program that we're building out and doing so very cost effectively. We received 3 out of 3 credit on this question. The next question, has your utility performed an internal or external analysis or planning study to help evaluate long-term needs of utility system infrastructure? And this is something that we do internally, and we're probably one of the few utilities of our size that actually have the capability to do this. For the APPA submission last time, we submitted our 2018 planning study that's developed in-house. And to give you a little bit of a flavor, it's a very substantial document that provides a roadmap for system requirements for many, many years into the future, 10, 15 years down the road. And it's, you know, well indexed, consisting of well over 200 pages that actually does the detailed analysis on every single feeder on the system, looking at voltage, looking at capacity, looking at load additions going into the future, as well as many planning assumptions and how we do this. This in conjunction with our 10-year capital plan, if we do that as we have been doing, much of this section answers the questions automatically in the affirmative. The planning study includes SPCC, many, many reference documents, including coordination and protection guidelines, as well as our 10-year capital improvement plan, which are derived from the planning study, which we do a comprehensive update every 3 years. For this, we receive 4 out of 4 points or full credit. Okay, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Sean to cover the financial health And I will stop sharing here. Okay.
Got it, like, John.
Okay, thanks.
Everybody can see my screen, I take it?
Yes.
Okay. I just have a few questions to go through here real quick. I had the tail end of the RP3 application. So my subsection is financial health. And the first question, which is 4C1, it asks us to provide a detailed description of projects that your utility has recently completed or will be working on in the near future, focused on the past 2 years and next 2 years to continually improve its system. So basically what they were asking here is they want to make sure that we were maintaining our system in the past, and do we plan to maintain it in the future. And by demonstrating that, we provided a 10-year electric budget, our presentations to the board, our 10-year vehicle and equipment procurement cycle, our 10-year capital plan, basically just illustrating that we're going to allocate sufficient resources in the future to make sure that our system is maintained. And so an example document here that we sent to them, it just goes over, you know, system improvements that we have done and that we plan to do to demonstrate compliance with this section. Again, we submitted a copy of our 10-year electric budget, and what they really honed in on here was, you know, our capital expenditures. What are we planning out 10 years in the future? Is it sufficient to maintain the reliability of our system? And it was, because this was one of the heavier sections that was weighted, and they gave us 5 out of 5 points on this particular question. On C2, they asked, does your utility have a policy or procedure to address the impact of customer-owned distribution energy resources on your utility's distribution system? I think one of the most impressive things that we sent them here, I didn't link to it, but we sent them a GIS screenshot of all the mapping of our interconnected customers. We sent them a copy of our policy for interconnection, which is actually quite robust. It's 40 pages long. It goes over the purpose and scope of our policy, as well as definitions and what it takes to become a net metered customer with the PUD. We also include an example packet that the customers receive from us when they apply. Basically get a response from us saying that you need to complete X, Y, and Z to complete your interconnection process, and once that's completed, you'll be a net metered customer of the district. A copy of the agreement, application for interconnection, and so on. This question here, we received full credit, which was 3 out of 3. And then finally, on the last question, has your utility implemented any policies and procedures to ensure financial health and stability? We sent them a copy of our most recent cost of service write-up from FCS Group. FCS also provides a detailed spreadsheet analysis that's quite detailed and robust. And we also sent them a copy of our rate design and our Moody's Investor service ratings. So when they look at our rates, they're seeing that the board – oh, it's on a different screen here. Hold on. They're seeing that the board is committed to ensuring that the financial health of the district is stable for the next 10 years. We break down the cost of the basic customer charge form for the next 10 years, as well as the kilowatt hour and the demand rates and what the total revenue impact is over the 10 years. It even goes over expected revenue by class for the next 10 years. Again, they're just wanting to make sure that we're allocating sufficient dollars to our system moving forward. And then the last thing I included was a copy of our press release from Moody's that talks about our credit rating, which was a AA3 rating with Moody's. And so with that, that concludes my section here. I don't know if, Nicole, if you had anything else to wrap up for the presentation.
No, I guess just if anybody has any questions about any part of that, this would be the time.
Maybe if I could just make a couple of comments here. I think after seeing all that's involved in RP3, you can see the details that we do get into, and it's kind of a good analysis for us to evaluate ourselves. I think that's one of the real important parts of it. When we first started this, when we started first looking into RP3 a number of years ago, this is our third one that we've achieved, so it was about 10 years ago or so. One of the things that came out of that was kind of the weakness we had with our documentation. So the RP3 actually has helped us to look into that further. And over the years, we've actually added more documentations so that we have a better feel for what we do and how we do it. And it kind of all is organized together. So I believe the benefits of the RP3 for us has been helping us to become a better, more organized utility. So any questions, all those participants are happy to answer any.
It looks like a lot of work, but I think it's well worth it. It is a benchmarking exercise, and we're looking at the metrics that a good utility should be looking at. So I think it's worth the effort.
This is Rick. I agree that it's worth the effort, and I'd like to congratulate the staff and Doug on the good job that they're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm sure all they do. And as John had mentioned, there's just not those four or five people involved. Most of the utilities involved in one step or other, adding to the documentation and adding to making, a better utility.
And I think that we, from a communication standpoint, we really need to get the word out that this is a big deal. This is a big deal for us as a small utility, or medium size, or large, or wherever we fall. and it's quite an endorsement of the job we're doing, and the staff is keeping up with this. That's great.
Well, this is John. I'll add that we're the smallest utility in Washington that's received the award.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're not going to do better next time. We're already at 100%, so we don't have much room for improvement with respect to RP3.
So you're saying that we can only go down?
Well, I hate to put it that way. We're gonna maintain what we're doing now.
Yeah, that's the right answer. Good, thank you.
Yeah, size wise, what John kind of said there too, is when you look at I'm trying to come up I-937, where we were 25,000 customers or higher were the ones that had to go with I-937. We were the smallest of those, but we were, one of the numbers that had to go for and get the I-937 requirement. So that's an extra effort that we've had to do over the years, in addition to all the things that you witnessed here too.
Yeah, I remember that. And, we may be a small utility or just barely make it into the medium size, but we're conducting our business professionally and so on. So it's a good endorsement.
I think Sean has something else he wanted to participate. Then, Will, I would suggest on time, maybe we move either do one of two things. Move Matthias's SCP to the end after I, or after commission reports, or move it to the next meeting. I guess depending on time, you all can decide what you want to do. But I would like to get through the other items, D through I, before we hit Matthias's smart energy provider, if that's okay.
Well, I was based on timing, and I was looking down the list here, and I guess I would recommend deferring Matthias's presentation to a future meeting, if that's okay with everybody. It's we got.
Yeah, I warned Matthias that might be the case.
Well, I know he's disappointed, but
am I survivable?
Well, that's okay. We'll do that. We'll defer.
Absolutely.
That. Okay. Good. All right, so let's move on to item B, which is the OLICAP low-income program to meet CETA compliance, from Sean.
Yeah, I just had a quick update here. So the first is on the arrears and the TRAP funds that are coming to Collin County. So I just have a quick slide on arrears, because I know that you have all asked questions about this in the past. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I pulled our 90-day arrears, and we had $3,364 in arrears. And as of April 30th, we had 217,000 that was 90+. So you can see on this nice little graph here that it's about a 6,500% increase in 90-day delinquencies since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, we had a little bit of a dip here in July to August, and that's because the first round of the CARES funding came through. So we were able to apply about $45,000 to customers that came to us from the county. And then since then, it's just skyrocketed. I don't have any good way to determine, you know, once the moratorium ends, how much of this balance will get paid by our customers with the threat of disconnect. There's just not really any way for me to know. But the good news is that TRAP funds have come to Collin County. That's the Treasury Rent Assistance Program. And Serenity House notified us a few weeks ago that they were going to be the recipient for Collin County. They received $4.8 million. And 10% of that $4.8 million is slated for utilities. The downside to the assistance is that it's only available to renters. And so, you know, looking back at the slide here, there's no way for us to know of this $217,000 how much of that is renters versus homeowners. You know, I'm assuming that it's about 60% renters. Just from some of the statistics that we've looked at in the past, but I don't know a definitive number because that's not something that we track. So it is only available to renters. They did notify us last week that they are ready to start accepting applications. So we have been marketing this like crazy. We've put messages on all of our bills that go out every single day. We've pulled lists of all of our customers that are past due, and we're sending them letters. Along with an application and letting them know that Serenity House is available and willing to help. And we've also sent robocalls to all of our customers that are in arrears. And again, as I said, Serenity House is accepting applications now. And so hopefully within the next 2 weeks, we'll start to receive checks from them that will start to deplete that 90-day balance that we have. So nothing has come in yet to my knowledge, but they did say from application to payment, they're probably going to pay every 2 weeks, and so there's going to be a little bit of a lag. But hopefully by the end of this month, we'll start to see a little bit of relief on our arrears. Any questions on that piece before I go into the next one?
John, this is Rick.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Sorry about that. I was curious, does the when an applicant or a renter submits an application, does the money come to them directly or does it come to the utility?
No, Serenity House – so the customer applies directly with Serenity House, but the money would come directly to us.
Okay. Thank you.
So what we provide Serenity House is we they asked us if we could give them a letter on our letterhead that says this customer has this balance and this much is in arrears. And so we've accommodated with all the requests that we've gotten so far. So we are receiving requests from Serenity House, so we do know that customers are applying, but I don't know yet what kind of funding they're gonna give. They just said that $480,000 is allocated to utilities. So I'm suspecting that would be split between us and City of Port Angeles most likely.
So a couple of questions first. Waputa was tracking the total exposure from all the PUDs. I think it, back some time ago it was $11 million. I guess that's probably been updated. And secondly, the well, I lost my thought. Oh, well. Anyway, do you know what that number is now?
I haven't heard of an updated one. Will, they just came out with Commerce just asked us this last week to submit a new survey with all updated amounts through the end of March, and I don't believe they'll have the results of that until beginning of June. They held a video conference call about it last week, and apparently WSU has sort of taken the lead and created a survey and is going to be analyzing the results and reporting to Commerce. I have gotten the impression that they are trying to figure out a way to unwind this moratorium. They're not exactly sure what the best way to do it is, because I think they've realized they've created a little bit of a mess, and want to make sure that when they do unwind it, that it's not terrible for the people that are in arrears. So I don't know what the updated number is, to answer your question, though.
Okay. The second question was, we were asking customers to make arrangements to pay this off on some time basis, maybe after the moratorium ends. How many of these do you think are doing that, or do we know how many is doing that?
We have set arrangements since day one with customers. The problem is that they keep getting broken, and in all honesty, there's no recourse, and so the customers don't have any necessarily an incentive to follow through on the arrangement when nothing will happen if they don't.
Yeah.
So that's been, we're sort of at a disadvantage there. But once the moratorium ends and, you know, there is the ability to disconnect for non-payment, I think it'll be a different story. But what that's actually going to look like, I just don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the second piece I had here was an update on our CETA and OLICAP. We gave a presentation to you board members a few weeks ago, John and I, sort of outlining our plan to implement a CETA-compliant low-income program. And so this is just an update on that presentation. We have signed a contract with OLICAP. We've had several meetings back and forth with them, very productive. They are in agreement to move forward and administer the program with us. We are disbursing $500,000 to them. However, they asked us to disperse the funds in a cycle that is contiguous with LIHEAP. And so what we did is we gave them $412,000 as the initial funding, and that will be for August 1st of this year through September 30th of next year. And then the remaining $88,000 will go to them along with the next budget cycle amount that the board approves later this year. So, again, it's just to coincide with the LIHEAP season. It was easier for them to administer the program that way. We have notified all of our existing customers via letters that the existing program, the PUD does in-house, is ending. And that generated a few phone calls, not too many, but just a few, and we were able to answer all those customers' questions. And the letter basically said that in the next few weeks you'll be notified when it's your turn to reapply for the new program through OLICAP. And the delay is primarily because OLICAP needs to staff up for this. We talk to them almost every other day through this process, and they are currently hiring, and I believe they have onboarded somebody. And they're going to get them trained, and so they'll start accepting applications for our new program in May. And we'll do it in about 100 customers at a time. We'll send out letters. There's about 1,200 customers that we need to get through that are on our existing program. We're going to try to do about 100 at a time to space them out so OLICAP's not inundated all at once. And when customers do apply, whether or not they receive a award through OLICAP for our program, they will notify us through electronic means that a customer did apply and what their amount that they receive will be. And this notification is to assist us with meeting the requirements of CETA so that we can report appropriately to Commerce. So outside of that, the program is in its infancy. It's up and running, so to speak. Everything is in place. We're just sort of waiting for OLICAP to give us the green light to start taking applications. And once that happens, I'll get with Nicole and we'll start advertising to our existing customers. So any questions on that update for CETA and OLICAP?
No, it looks like we've got a good program going. It's good.
We do. So, all right. Well, thank you, commissioners. I appreciate your time.
All right, I would recommend taking a short break here, maybe 5 minutes or so, and then we can come back and tackle the rest of this, if that's okay. So let's be back in 5 minutes. Let's say, 3:13 or so. Okay, looks like everybody's back. We'll move on to our next item, which is a bid award recommendation memo number 210802 for an underground puller. Terry, are you on?
I sure am.
Go ahead.
Terry Lind here. I'm the operations superintendent at the Port Angeles Operations Center, including the district's fleet. On April 29, 2021, we opened bids for a Sherman Riley diesel engine trailer-mounted underground puller model DDXA-75. We got quotes from three different sources, and Sherman Riley was the lowest quote. In the end, we only received one bid, and it was from Sherman Riley. Staff requests a motion, second, and a vote for the board to authorize staff to award bid number 210802 to purchase a Sherman Riley diesel engine trailer-mounted underground puller DDXA-75 from Sherman Riley Incorporated for a purchase price of $175,964, not including Washington State sales tax. Thank you. Can I answer any questions?
Now we have go ahead.
Sorry, Terry, this is Rick.
Hi, Rick.
I understood you to say that you requested three bids, but you only got one.
Yeah, that's right. We sent out and we got quotes from three different vendors, but when the bids actually came in, we only received one. I don't know why.
Was there a big discrepancy in the bids?
No. They were all within about $12,000 or $15,000.
So it's about, what, 7% of each other?
Yes.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, but thank you.
So we have a smaller puller already, is it? Is that how I recall that?
Yes, we do have, we've got two of the smaller pullers, the puppy dogs. This is the duct dog. And we do have one other duct dog stationed out in Forks.
So we're going to keep those, or are we going to?
We are going to keep them. The one that this one is replacing is a 1986 model, and it's still got some life in it. We're still going to use it for real small pulls, but we expect it to be surplus in the next couple of years. It doesn't. The puppy dogs don't pull the length that we're pulling anymore, and they can't pull the weight of the larger cables that we're pulling. So we've kind of outgrown it. And we've been doing those kind of pulls with a capstan, which is extremely slow and very large equipment, hard to get set up with.
Okay, thank you. Do I have a motion on this one?
I move that we approve memo 210802.
All right, I see what you're. All right, I second that. You may need to read that out for the record, Will.
Okay, I will. It's been moved and seconded that the board authorizes awarding bid number 210802 to purchase a Sherman Riley diesel engine trailer mounted puller DDXA-75 from Sherman Riley Inc. for a purchase price of $175,964. No cents, not including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
All right, our next item is a bid award recommendation 211003, pole inspection, treating, and reporting. Bill, I think you've got that one. Bill Decker,
hello,
is he
everybody
on?
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah, there you are.
Yeah. Well, I'm Bill. I'm the superintendent out on the West End. It's nice to see you, Rick. What I'd like to, this is for bid award recommendation memo for the bid opening that was on April 20th, 2021. It's for pole inspection, treating, and reporting. Bid number 211003. It is recommended that the above referenced bid for pole inspection, treating, and reporting for 2021 be awarded to Pacific Pole Inspection, LLC from Kelso, Washington, the lowest responsible bidder. Bid tabulation form is closed for review. This contract will have an estimated not to exceed amount of $129,368. and no sense, not including Washington State sales taxes, to be complete by November 5th, 2021.
I don't see the bid tabulations on this one or the previous one. That's always good information to have. Not a problem, hopefully. Any questions, comments on this?
No, I'll move that we authorize the staff to award bid number 211003 for pole inspection treating and reporting to Pacific Pole Inspection LLC from Kelso, Washington. The contract will have an estimated not to exceed amount of $129,368,000, not including Washington State sales taxes.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded to authorize staff to award bid number 211003 for pole inspection, treating, and reporting to Pacific Pole Inspection LLC from Kelso, Washington. This contract will have an estimated not to exceed amount of $129,368, no cents, not including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Bill, is that on unit pricing or?
Yeah, it's based on a unit price per pole, transmission, distribution, et cetera.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, our next item is a resolution 2196 establishing the current schedule of deposits and charges, electrical line extension unit prices. Travis, are you on?
I'm here.
Good. Go for it.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Travis. I'm the Water and Wastewater Systems Coordinator. I'm here to recommend the passing of resolution 2196-21 to establish an updated schedule of deposits and charges and electric line extension unit prices, and then rescind the previous versions. We reevaluate these charges on an annual basis to account for changes in costs associated with wages and benefits, materials, permits from other agencies. This is kind of a group effort between a lot of different departments, customer service, finance, electrical operations, water engineering. Xanthius Christensen, who's on here also, did most of the electric construction costs and line extension unit cost updates for the year. So we're kind of trying to stay in line with our strategic objectives to provide stable rates, and by accurately capturing, you know, the costs that we incur for different services rendered, we can kind of help support rate stability for our customers and kind of put the costs related to specific construction or specific tasks on the customers incurring those costs.
Travis, this is Rick.
Hi.
Since you currently have gone through and reviewed a lot of these prices, I'm wondering if anything has jumped out at you through this analysis.
No, most of our cost updates this year, we tried not to take things apart and reinvent the wheel too much. We were mostly updating for strictly materials and, you know, increases to wages and benefits. As you know, we did represented employees had a wage increase that took effect May 1st. So that's kind of a driving factor behind a lot of these cost updates. Sometimes in years past, we tried to take apart all the nuts and bolts of these charges and reevaluate them down to the little nitty-gritty. We tried to kind of keep things more or less even this year with last year, especially with you know, COVID and some of the other challenges, and just kind of do an adjustment strictly for materials and for labor. With the exception of, we do have one charge in the water department, which is the fire hydrant temporary usage charge. We adapted that a little bit to be more in line with kind of industry best practices and what other utilities do, and provide kind of a base amount of daily use and base amount of water included with that charge, as opposed to pointing back to our rate schedule.
I think that was a good idea.
You know, as far as material costs, what you hear, building materials, lumber, steel, copper, everything's just skyrocketing up. Did you build some contingency in these numbers, or do you just use what's current?
We use the accounting average inventory cost for how we calculate these. So it is averaged amongst different groups of material purchases. So to some extent, if we got a good price on something several years ago, it may actually bring that cost down a little bit because it is averaging our inventory costs. On the electric side, I don't know if Xanthi might be able to speak better to that, whether we had anything that was that jumped out as far as a big price spike. I think he may have noted one on the unit cost document where we had a cabinet or something that jumped up in cost.
Hello, I'm Xanthi Christensen. I'm an electrical engineer here. I went through all the unit costs. We, as Travis explained before, we did have a three-phase electrical service cabinet jump up about $20,000.
What percent is that?
I think it's about, I think the last one was somewhere around $5,000. So, yeah.
So. But there's no inflation.
No. And that also could be because we haven't bought one for years. So there could have been, we've had these cabinets sitting around. We can install them as we go. And this one was the one where we started purchasing them again. So it, inflation. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, this is John. You're absolutely correct there. We had a fairly large inventory of switchgear and such. And they were exhausted, and I think we had to go out for a procurement of more, including a procurement of what we call grounded front equipment. So that is correct. Will, to your point, is definitely lagging by a considerable amount. So we won't see the escalations over the recent history in this year until next year or the year after.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, this is Sean. One thing I wanted to point out real quick, you probably saw it on the Redline version, but we have eliminated the self-read opt-out option. We have ran that since we started our AMI project. We only have one customer that has elected to pursue the self-read option, and due to the extreme manual nature of tracking that, we have eliminated that from the deposits and charges as an option moving forward. So I just wanted to bring your attention to that program would cease just due to the sheer fact that when we rolled out the estimate for how much it would cost the utility, we had 200 customers that we estimated would enroll in that, and we currently have one that is paying that fee.
Yeah, that's a legacy from the smart meter thing, I think.
It is, yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
If we put this schedule out for notice to the public or to the customers prior to Thursday or Friday of this week or past week, I noticed it was in the paper. You had it in the article yesterday, an article, you know, listing this would be a topic, but I'm just wondering if the public has had a chance, a courtesy look for some period of time.
No, we haven't. Posted outside of the board packet. This is one of those things that we do every year and update it on a yearly basis. Typically, it coincides with the wage adjustment in the CBA. But no, to answer your question, we didn't put this out before the board packet.
Well, okay. So last August when we did this, same thing, and I suggested as a matter of courtesy to our customers and whoever, that we post this for at least a week or two. So I'm wondering if we can't just, since you're looking for a June 1st implementation, if we can just postpone this till the next meeting to vote on it so that we get it out there for public notice for 2 weeks.
That would be the commission prerogative, whatever you all decide.
Rick, what do you think? I guess my observation would be that, you know, it's not going to change the numbers. These are usually based on pretty good data. It may not be good news, but it's not really open to debate. So,
The only thing I'll add is I think we did last year post on it a couple of weeks for some customer comment. If there were any, I did not get any comment, or I don't think we had anything relayed to us, you know, from any customers who reviewed it. I think, as you pointed out, well, it is pretty much just cost-based. So, you know, I don't know where there would be much room for, you know, adjustment. We're pretty much just accounting for time spent on a given task.
Would it be a hardship to not release it, or for us to postpone the vote till the next meeting?
I think the only issue would be if for some reason we had any changes to it, our customer service department and engineering departments do need some lead time to be able to update, you know, different forms for estimates and charges and stuff in CIS. So if it were going to remain the same, they've already had a chance to review this and kind of start their work on that. Should it be passed, you know, I think if we passed it at a future meeting, it wouldn't necessarily represent a hardship unless we had drastic changes that were made, which I wouldn't anticipate.
Yeah, once it's approved, Rick, just to answer your question, every single charge that's laid out there, somebody has to go in and update the system with all the charges. So that piece of it is manual, and it does take a little bit of time to complete that task.
I guess the only impact I can think of, if somebody's planning a project or to build a house or whatever, and increased numbers kind of push them past the choke point. So I guess that's a possibility.
Well, I'm okay with holding it up for a week. Jim, if you think it's that important, I don't understand really what kind of feedback that you're looking for, but.
Rick, it's mostly about, hey, it's a rate increase, and we ought to give the public at least a week or two to say, you know, just in case you want to comment. There may be somebody that has a question or something. That's just, I think, fair to our customers, simply is a fair prerogative. I don't expect a lot of feedback, no, but there may be something.
Sure. Okay. Well, since it's not a big deal, or it doesn't seem like it's going to be very much of a hardship for the staff, let's wait until the next meeting.
Yeah, that's the conclusion we reached last year, and it was all about the optics. So, okay, well, let's defer this one to the next meeting.
I'll ask staff if we can just remember next year to do it ahead of time.
That'd be good.
Yeah. Well, I apologize, Jim. When it came out, I didn't think of it, and maybe we probably should have. But we can try to put that on our calendar to make sure we do it a couple of weeks ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Hey, gentlemen. See you guys on the 24th.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Thank you. Okay. The next item is Resolution 2197-21, amending the district's health care plan. Jamie?
Yes, I am back, and I'm actually, for this first resolution, going to share my screen. I put together some information for you guys. Excuse me a second. Well, that's not the screen I want to share. There it is. Why is it blue? Okay, hold on a sec. My PowerPoint. Are you able to see that right now?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, let me get. So we often do not have changes to our healthcare plan, and with two newer commissioners, I thought it was appropriate to kind of have some additional data here, so I'd like to just take a couple minutes. Here at the district, we have a healthcare committee, and it is made up of half union employees and half staff employees. And that committee is very active when they review any recommendations. You know, if we get a lot of feedback from employees on a certain area or an issue that we might have within our healthcare plan, and they can help make, you know, go through the review process and then make any recommendations for changes to the plan. So currently, we have had some discussions regarding these three areas. And so in our dental, looking at our yearly maximum for our dental benefits, which are currently $1,500 every calendar year, as well as the maximum lifetime orthodontia benefit, which is $1,500 every calendar year. And then vision, under that section, our hardware benefit is $200 per year, and that includes frames, lenses, and contact lenses for our employees. So when I start interacting with the healthcare committee, because they bring forward, you know, some areas that they want to discuss, we will sit back and kind of do, I will collect a bunch of information for them. And so first off, we looked at when was the last time we made changes to any of those areas. So back in 2008, our dental maximum was adjusted to $1,500 per calendar year. Prior to that, it was $2,000 every 2 years. And then the vision hardware was changed to a flat $200 per year benefit for frames, lenses, and contact lenses. And before that, it was, I believe it was $300 every 2 years. So instead of a 2 year rotation, we went to a yearly calendar. And I think that just helped people, you know, if they had to buy contact lenses on a regular basis or something like that, they had the money there. And then I go out, I think an HR person always is going to do comps. And so what I did is I gathered information. We are part of Pacific Underwriters Firm, so we are pulled together with a handful of other utilities. All of them are listed here. And then there's some additional, some maybe on liability insurance, but not under the healthcare. So like a good example on this one, Mason 3, their dental is not under PERMS, but I also hold theirs because they're a comparable utility for us. So I looked at yearly maximums, and you can see that compared to some of the other utilities, we are in the lower three. NOAA-Net, I'll just make a side note, is not a good example. They have no maximums. They have a very rich healthcare plan. They have a very small, you know, employee base that's on there. Everyone would love to have that plan, but so you'll see them ranked really high on these comparisons. So went over and looked even in orthodontia for the lifetime maximum benefit. We are lower at that $1,500 as well. I was also able to pull vision. So when you look at, you know, your eye exam coverage, it's 100%. We always want to encourage people to get those yearly eye exams. But then looking at the lenses, contact, frame coverage, we are, you know, definitely ranked lower at that $200 per calendar year as well on that. You will see some of them do 100% coverage on a two-year rotation. But when you look at the yearlies, we are sitting lower on the schedule. And then also through the evaluation process, I work with PERMS to gather information for the healthcare committee to take on, you know, their consideration for any changes. And so I always ask our contacts there to perform a look back. And what that means is, you know, I will propose to him the potential changes and say, can you look back at our last year's experience and how would that have impacted the plan? So with the changes that are proposed here in the resolution, Dick at PERMS took that information, ran it off of our usage last year, and he came back that based off of that, it was estimated that the changes would have cost the plan, the total healthcare plan, an additional $38,000. Having further conversation with Sean Worthington regarding the district's budget, that was less than 1% of an effect it would have on the district's budget there. Then I went out, even gathered more information because, you know, why are we wanting to increase these dental costs? So according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, They identified that the average inflation rate of there was a 2.43% over the last 10 years for dental services. Vision care over that same time frame has increased 0.8%. But it's interesting right now, you know, with the pandemic, seeing what like dentists are being challenged with. There's a lot of discussion out there in the news about like PPE charges. They are calling them infectious control fees and how they're going to incorporate those into billing. You know, our dentists are having to layer up more, provide the specific protection for their employees as well as themselves. There's also longer cleaning time, so they're not being able to see as many patients. And so that's definitely going to impact our dental rates, you know, in the big picture. I don't think a lot of articles on people not going to the dentist during the pandemic, but we didn't see that. We saw traditional usage from our employees during the pandemic. You know, we really encourage people that dental health is important going from there. So all of this information was taken back to the healthcare committee. They evaluated, you know, those three areas under the yearly maximum for dental, the lifetime maximum for orthodontia, and then the vision hardware. And this is the recommendation that was brought back that you'll see included in Resolution 2197-21, that the yearly maximum dental benefit go from $1,500 every calendar year to $3,000. Update the maximum lifetime orthodontia benefit. So that's kind of a one-time benefit. You exhaust it there if you had braces as a teenager or when you first got on higher tier and then 20 years later you want to have another set again, you've exhausted that benefit. So that one increasing from $1,500 in the calendar year to $3,000. And then the hardware benefit being adjusted from $200 per year to $300 per year for our employees and dependents that are on the healthcare plans. So with that information, I'm here to make the recommendation of passing Resolution 2197-21, making the changes to the healthcare plan as shown on the attached summary to the resolution. With an effective date of January 1, 2021. So we would be taking it back just because it's a yearly amount. So we wouldn't want any employees or dependents who have already been to the dentist this year to and maybe exhausted their benefit to miss out on the additional amounts that may be added with your guys' approval. Any questions?
So the orthodontist benefit, that's per employee. I mean, if he's got three kids that need braces, he's out of luck.
Well, it's actually per individual. So thankfully, because with the price of braces nowadays, that would go real quick if you had to share it between three kids.
Well, I can say unequivocally, I'll never have braces again. So
Yes. From personal experience, it's interesting now. They're sending children, dentists are at a lot younger age to the orthodontist than 20 years ago, and for interesting things too, monitoring tooth development and things like that.
Yeah. Okay, questions, comments? We have a motion.
Okay, I move that we approve Resolution 2198-21. 2197-21, amending the district's health care plan.
I second.
Moved and seconded to adopt Resolution 2197-21, amending the district's health care plan. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, you guys.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I'm not going away. I have two more resolutions, so I apologize.
You are a lot of trouble.
Okay. I am today. Yeah, you guys won't see me for the next 6 months after this.
Okay, the next resolution, next item is Resolution 2198-21, the resolution and policy for tuition reimbursement. And that's Jamie again.
Yes. So going through our tuition reimbursement policy, we noticed that there was a conflict or discrepancy in the information. So I know T emailed to the board today the draft one I had that showed the edits, what I was removing and what I was adding. So we needed to remove a section under the does not include. That contradicted with the reimbursement section level. So it's just a cleanup there that we'd like to do. And then we've added a section at the bottom of reimbursement that reimbursement may be subject to applicable taxes per the IRS. There are limits, and if employees exceed those, then there is reporting that payroll due for tax purposes on that. So we are just asking that you guys pass resolution number 2198-21 amending the tuitions reimbursement program.
Now, I assume there's grade requirements and attendance requirements in this.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's definitely our program's become more refined over time. And, you know, we will see courses added to offer letters. They can be even incorporated in job description requirements. Some of our accounting positions, they have required courses they have to take if they haven't already done so. And so you will see, you know, if they're contingent in a job offer, they'll be covered at a different level depending if they get a grade A or a grade B. And so we do have some responsibility on the employees, which, you know, definitely pushes them to work harder to get higher reimbursement from the district.
And this would include online courses as well, I guess.
Yeah, that's another area where the program has definitely expanded. You know, I don't know how many years ago I took advantage of this, over 10 years ago when I took advantage of this program, online schools weren't as popular as they were. And I remember having those discussions because I was looking at an online university. So, yeah, it's, and now that's, especially during a pandemic,
yeah,
you know, that's the norm.
That's
yep.
The norm. That's right.
Absolutely.
Well, I move that we accept resolution 2198-21, resolution and policy for tuition reimbursement.
I second it.
Been moved and seconded to adopt resolution 2198-21, providing for college level course tuition reimbursement and rescinding resolution 2060-16. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay, Jamie, you've got the next one. Resolution 2199-21, establishing a professional licensing and membership policy.
Yes, absolutely. So the purpose of this policy is the district definitely has an interest in keeping employees current on issues and technical advancements related to our industry while maintaining a high community profile through employee involvement in civic service and professional organizations. And then with these goals in mind, the district would like to establish this policy dealing with memberships and professional licenses, which I think ties back perfectly to the RT3 sections I did, you know, as a new policy for our next application that we'll be able to add in there, even supporting more how important it is that our employees involved in stuff. And so we've always, you know, definitely supported people, but I think as we see employees being more eager to develop, we're getting more questions on different courses or memberships that they would like to participate in just to, you know, further their growth. And we didn't really have any outlining a process or how we were going to reimburse that, you know, on district time, off district time. And so this policy allows us to do that and have those guidelines to give to them when they inquire on stuff.
Do we require electrical engineers to have a PE license? I guess a question for John. Or...
Yeah, John can help with that. I know we have some. We highly encourage it, definitely for our engineering manager that has been a contingency for employment.
Currently we require that any position, senior engineer or supervisor or manager position at the PUD either have or obtain their professional license within a certain period of time.
Okay. Great. Questions, discussion? Motion?
I move that we adopt Resolution 2199-21, establishing a professional license and membership policy.
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded to adopt Resolution 2199-21, establishing a professional licensing and membership policy. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you very much, Board.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. So we'll see you again in 6 months to a year, right?
Yes, you can hold me to that.
No, we always enjoy seeing you. That's great.
Likewise.
Okay, the next item is correspondence communication. Doug, do we have any?
Sorry, Will. No, nothing today, Will.
Okay. All right, commissioner reports. You want to start it off, Rick?
Yeah. I attended a number of WAPUTA meetings, new commissioner orientation, energy committee, and their board. I was at the renewable energy audit meeting and the entrance conference for accountability and financial audit, which was, I thought was pretty interesting. And I was really pleased with the results of that. That's all I've got, Will.
Okay. Thank you. Jim?
I attended WAPUTA meeting, and just want to point out that that one of the things they did was they had several associations come in and brief. So Northwest Public Power Association gave a briefing on what they do, Public Power Council, and Northwest Energy Coalition, not Northwest Energy, but Energy Northwest. And let's see what else did WAPUTA. It was Rick said some education meetings. I suggested that the education committee propose maybe a briefing from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council on their draft plan that's coming out in July. We'll see what happens with that. They said they would, but we'll see. Let's see, anything else? They covered a lot of legislative stuff, but that's probably all OBE now. Hopefully the B&O tax exemption passed. And let's see, Scott Wilson from BPA didn't really have anything all that big to say. Then the other thing was a WAPAG meeting the 29th of April. We went over the provider of choice, which is what they call the 2028 contract process, and went over some of that in terms of what they're going to do. They said the BPA will be coming to the PUDs and briefed if we ask them to, so we certainly want to have our briefing from BPA. Let's see what else. Oh, the other thing WAPAG is doing is setting up a model with on provider of choice that will help us understand how these different loads and generation and rates and resource impacts can play out in different scenarios or different contract scenarios. It will help us understand which is our best choice of selecting a contract with BPA in the future. So I think that'll be a great help to us, is and that'll be almost like an additional WAPAG line of action or process to set that up and get it going. The WAPAG also briefed out on the Power and Conservation Council a little bit. One of the things that we briefly discussed at that meeting, and also brought it out again at the Power Council meeting, was the fact that the hydro system cost that they're assuming in all these models are fixed or zeroed out because they assume that these scenarios they're playing, that that since that's a fixed cost, there's no point in modeling it. And I think that's wrong, and I pointed that out, because it means we're flying blind over the next 20-something years on the assumption that, well, we don't know what the costs of the hydro system are. So I don't know how you can understand or make a fair assessment about affordability and reliability about the whole Northwest and BPA if you don't know what those costs are. I also attended quite a few of the meetings the council is having over since the last meeting, and I've got pages of note here, and so it's just way too much to try to go over in detail, so I'll try to summarize it. But where it kind of ended up last week on the power meeting on Tuesday and the council meeting on Wednesday is the staff was, you know, through all this process of pointing out that the amount of surplus energy that we're dealing with today, primarily from California, which is a lot of solar and hydropower, particularly in the springtime, is actually driving prices low enough to the point that the natural gas plants, some of them, are basically competing against prices that are too low, or so they're unable to commit their units for reserves for to create what is now perceived to be a resource adequacy problem in the first quarter of 2023 of about 1,600 megawatts. And so essentially what the irony here is that we've got so much power, it's driving prices down below what the gas providers can be willing to basically operate that plant to make money. And so they're not willing to put it in a reserve as well to hold it for those peak events. And so the model is showing, for instance, this deficit in the first quarter is not a for sure thing. It's just one of these things. If we have a low water event, we may end up in a situation where we have a resource adequacy issue. But it's driven because we've got too much cheap power that's taking offline or stranding the assets, as one of the commissioner council members noted, of some of the gas plants. And they pointed out this is exactly what happened in California last summer when they had the heat wave, and there was gas plants that normally would have been operating, but they were not standing by or not in a position to respond quick enough to the increases in loads, and that's what drove the prices up. So that's bad news for them, good news for Bonneville. They made some money off of that. But it's kind of an irony of the situation that we're in right now is that with the way the model is chasing prices and so forth. So I think that's something that why, you know, just one of the many reasons we need to pay attention to what the council is coming up with and their modeling and their draft plans that are due out shortly. And I'll stop there, Will.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I attended the Waputa meetings as well, but sounds like we've covered those. We had a joint meeting of the board of directors and the executive board at Energy Northwest on 4/21/22. Had a presentation from PNNL, Vincent Speckel, senior advisor on energy storage. I don't believe he was one of the presenters we saw here, but anyway, had some interesting data and comments about batteries. They're calling that new facility at PNNL the launch pad, and it won't be complete until 2023. It's about a $75 million facility. The emphasis on their research is cost, safety, reliability, problems with the lithium-ion battery technology, impact to the system, performance, life expectancy, life cycle, capital expenditure, and that's their marching orders. They're shooting for lithium-ion batteries, which is going to be the technology going forward, they're saying, for the next 10 years or so, to get from a maximum of 300 watt-hours per kilogram to 500. To see the problem with lithium iron and one of the ion, which is supply chain, it's all foreign. They're still working on the redox flow design, which we looked at for the Horns Rapid solar plant at Energy Northwest, and later on they withdrew that as a contender, and they went with lithium ion. Sodium, again, supply chain is an issue. They're looking also at zinc, manganese oxide, like common batteries, which are rechargeable. And the goal is to perfect 100 kilowatt systems. You know, most home generators, propane or natural gas, are can be 20 kilowatts or so. So that would be a big improvement. They said that the U.S. is the largest user of batteries, but overwhelmingly most are manufactured overseas, mainly in China. So you hear a lot of talk about new facilities like Elon Musk and so on, but they haven't done a lot of market penetration yet. We also had John Hairston in the meeting, and he announced that Joel Cook will be the new chief operating officer. He went on about the increase in rates, 5.8% increase in transmission. Rates, the final rates will be out in July. He talked about the EIM decision to join will be in September. And talked about resource adequacy. BPA is working with the Northwest Power Pool, which is kind of leading the charge on resource adequacy. And let's see what else is. And we submitted a bunch of questions for him prior to the meeting, and he responded to those. And I won't get into all that, but it was kind of interesting. One of the questions was about, of course, the Texas and the California story, and he says that they're trying to protect the Northwest from California or Texas scenarios. EIM impact on preference customers, they're evaluating the risk factors. You know, they put out one paper on this, but they're still massaging it, so we'll see more on that. And also talked about the regional conservation, I'm sorry, cooperation debt, which Energy Northwest is borrowing money at lower interest rates to help Bonneville out. And it's all, and now it's all about the access to capital. We have approved a $3.6 billion program for phase two at Energy Northwest. Executive Board approved that. And that's going to go over the next 10 years. And so it seems that Bonneville would be drawing on that quite a bit. They're also working at trying to get more borrowing authority through Congress. And they talked about leverage. Transmission is 40 to 50% debt service. The power side is 87% leveraged. It's down from 90-some-odd percent. And the reserves issue is looking better. He didn't elaborate on that, so I assume that they're maybe somewhat out of the woods. Then, of course, we had the CEO report for Energy Northwest. They're into a refueling outage right now, which is going to be a number of major projects will be performed during that, which is always problematic for the duration of the outage and so on. That's kind of compounded because our CEO, Brad Swirsky, has agreed to stay through the refueling outage, and but he has set a hard date of May the 30th for departure. And so if that outage is extended, he's made noises, yeah, I may be available to help out, but we'll see how that goes. The I'm on the CEO selection committee. We're recommending going outside for recruiting as kind of a due diligence, although we've got some good internal candidates. And in the interim, to bridge over this outage period and give us time to look for an external candidate, we are we're recommending an interim CEO from an internal candidate. I'll talk about the COVID thing. They've got 110 COVID cases, about 10% of the workers there. 80% have been vaccinated. So that's not too bad of news, and especially going into a refueling outage. They're in union negotiations. It's gone to arbitration. Union's asking for a 10% wage increase with 5% per year for the duration of the contract. The chief nuclear officer gave a report. They've been online for 311 days. The total, the breaker to breaker, from closing the breaker to opening the breaker, which would be the runtime, the record was 683 days. And now they're up to about 681. So that they won't break that record since they went into the refueling outage. Let's see what else. I won't talk about all those projects. The engineering service development report was all good, with Nine Canyon and wind farm at 98.73% availability, Packwood, water's good, and so on. They received a grant for EV charging stations for six stations along Highway 12, plus there was an additional $667,000 for two more stations. And we talked about, I always ask this question, well, what about the Highway 101 loop on the Olympic Peninsula? And they're working that issue. Nothing firm yet, but that would be a boom for tourism out here and so on. ES&D is offering legal services, and the Port of Pasco is taking them up on this. This is a new thing, which they've got a pretty large legal department of Energy Northwest, and they're going to draw on that to provide legal services to utilities who wish to have those services. And I think we've talked about the new nuclear thing, the Tri-Energy, which was Grant Utility, X-Energy and Energy Northwest. TerraPower is kind of lagging and getting on board with that, and it's, whether or not they'll partner with Energy Northwest is kind of we've got a memo of understanding, but we'll see how that goes. Let's see. I won't go into all the legislative updates. That's depressing. The BPA report said that the water supply is at 89% of normal, and normal runoff is forecast. So that's that report. Any questions, anything?
Will, how long is the outage at Columbia?
Should be through the end of the month.
Okay, thanks.
Now you know, all the incentive payments, at-risk compensation, and all that is based on something like a 28-day outage. They've done better than that in the past, but they've also done a lot worse. And they always do worse when there's a lot of major projects, which we do have in this outage. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, staff reports. Doug, do we have any?
Yeah, well, just a few things real quick. We've been trying to figure out how to include the action items from the board. So at the end of the meeting, the board always sees whether they have any staff action items.
Yeah.
And we really haven't had any place in the past where to give you feedback on that. So I think in the future meetings, we're going to stick it under staff reports, which makes sense. So you'll see that now. As a result of that, the board action item, we had an action item last time that Rick had brought up about risk mitigation as it pertains to potential wildfires. And we've got that scheduled for the June 8th meeting. So that will be a presentation that will be given to the board then. And then recently, we've had some public requesting about solar with the PUD and what the PUD is doing, and so we've got a presentation planned in the future here, a workshop, maybe part of a business meeting on PUD and the solar future we see, and what we've done also, and where we stand in relating to other utilities, and how pro solar we have actually been, even though some don't actually consider that we are. And the last thing I have is, as you know, BPA 2028 contracts are being looked at and worked on. And I guess we're assuming that the commissioners would like to be involved in that. So we have to work out some ways on how to do that, because there'll be a lot of meetings going on. There'll be a lot of correspondence back and forth. And we'll have to figure out for any commissioner that wants to be involved, you know, how we do that. So that's something we can talk about at future meetings, too. That's all I've got.
Okay, good, good. All right, so our next item is board action items. Did we capture any tea?
Yes, we did, Will. Staff is to resubmit to the board resolution 2196-21, establishing the current schedule of deposits and charges on electric line extension prices at the upcoming meeting on May 24th.
And I believe we... the Smart Energy Provider presentation from Mathaz, we're going to do that one.
Yes, that was an agenda revision, and that will be at the next meeting or a following meeting, depending on how many business items we have at the next meeting.
Okay. It should be at the next meeting.
Yeah, let's try to do it. We apologize to Mathaz. Sorry. Okay, next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have any?
We do have two members of the public left in our meeting here, so if Patty or Paula would like to make a comment, please let me know, and I'll have you make it. Doesn't look like it, Will.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's no other business to come before the commission, we will stand adjourned. Thanks for participating.